I like that song, Waymaker, Miracle Worker, Promise Keeper, Light in the Darkness. And, you know, I like that phrase there, that God is the Promise Keeper. And really, that's what we're going to be discussing a little bit tonight, is the first gospel promise that God gave humanity was to who? Hey, Carrie, good to see you. Neff and Deb, good to see you. Was a promise that God gave to Adam and Eve after they sinned, right? What was the promise? That there would be a seed that would be born that would crush the serpent's head. And that promise has been fulfilled. God has kept his promise in the person of Jesus Christ, and we are recipients of that promise just as much as Adam and Eve were. So thanks for everyone coming out tonight. I know there's a few other people said they'd be here. Hopefully we'll get a little more packed in. If you have not received your book yet, I know there are about five people who still needed to receive a book. Make sure you get one after the service here. I have them over here on the side. You can pick up your book tonight. But I know we've got at least 30 people who have gotten the book and want to go through this study with us, so that's encouraging. And, you know, last week, if you were here, you know, we set the stage by going through the first portion of the book, which was Genesis 1, and tonight we're going to be looking at Genesis 2 through Genesis 10, all the way up to the story of the Tower of Babel. Hey, Carol and Mark, good to see you guys. And what Genesis 2 is doing is it's really giving a fuller explanation of what happened on the sixth day that was described in Genesis 1. And what Genesis 2 especially focuses on was God's greatest creation on day 6, which was what? It was man and woman. It wasn't all the animals, but man and woman. Man was the crown of God's very good creation, and woman really was the jewel in the crown. Both man and woman, it says, are made in the image and likeness of God. In fact, this is what Psalm 8 says about the glory of man. Thou hast made him a little lower than God, and dost crown him with glory and majesty. Thou dost make him to rule over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. That's Psalm 8, verses 3 to 6. It just shows the position and the place and the dignity and the grandeur of man in God's created world. Now, at the beginning, if you've been following in the second section of this book, A House for My Name, this is how Lightheart opens this section. He writes this: once God has made his three-story house, he puts Adam and Eve in it and gives them a job to do. In Genesis 1, 26 to 28, God makes Adam and Eve in his image and likeness. An image is a copy, and Adam and Eve are created to be like God. As God is king of the whole creation, so Adam is to be king of the animals and birds, and Eve the queen at his side. Being like God also means that Adam is supposed to work as God works. Now, anyone remember what the lie of the serpent was when the serpent comes to Eve? What did he promise Eve would happen if she partook of the forbidden fruit? That she would be like God. But what was the truth about Eve already? She already was like God, right? She was created in his image and his likeness. She was created as the magnificent queen of God's house. She was created to rule like God rules. She was to be an imitator of God. God would grow her in maturity as she listened to him rather than the serpent, but she listens to the lie of the serpent. She partakes of forbidden fruit, and we all know what happens. She falls. But she didn't recognize her dignity and her place of being an image bearer, a likeness bearer of God. And you know, a lot of great theologians throughout church history have described the dignity of Adam and Eve in terms of kings and queens of God's creation. In fact, One of the first theologians in the church was a man by Irenaeus, and he lived in Lyon, in where modern-day France is. And this is what he wrote at the end of the second century about Adam and Eve. He said this, "The creation is suited for the benefit of man, for man was not made for its sake, but creation for the sake of man." Now later, a couple centuries later, Gregory of Nazianzus, he wrote this, "If man appeared in the world last, honored by the handiwork and image of God, this is not in the least surprising, since for him, as for a king, the royal dwelling had to be prepared, and only then was the king to be let in, accompanied by all creatures." Now, in more recent times, one of the most prolific and famous Reformed theologians in the 19th century, a guy by the name of Herman Bavinck, he was writing at a time when the dignity of man was being lowered to the dignity of an ape-like creature, right after the theory of evolution came in the 19th century with Darwin. And this is what he said about man. He said this, "Man was not created a savage, but a being with lofty intellectual powers. The development of man from an originally low order of intellectual beings closely resembling the ape is a figment of unbridled imagining, falsely dubbed science." So what is the purpose of lofty, highly intellectual creature made in the likeness and image of God? Well, Lightheart, he says this in this section. He says, "Adam's job is to subdue and to rule." In Genesis 4:22, we learn that Tubal-Cain is the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. He is the first to enslave the metals that God has created and make them useful. Today, thousands of years later, we are still learning new ways to subdue creation. And this is simply men and women walking out the calling, the vocation that God originally gave us. It is good. Scientific development and technology is good. Now, last week I mentioned how Adam watched God's creative work on day six, right? Right after God creates Adam from the dust of the ground and breathes him in the breath of life, it says that God goes on to plant a garden. And what does he do after he plants the garden? And Adam is probably, I imagine, watching how God works in his world, planting the garden. He puts Adam in the garden. And God was showing Adam how to have dominion over his very good created world. He was showing Adam how to subdue, how to rule, how to create. Adam, the image and likeness of God, was called to imitate God's very good work in bringing order, in bringing beauty, in bringing a garden-like atmosphere to his world and to the ends of the earth. Now, Adam, we see in the beginning, has two roles. He has a kingly role and he has a priestly role. And we see some of his descendants, like Tubal-Cain, like Jabal, like Jubal, who begin to make full use of the intelligence and creativity that God created them with. It talks about, Genesis 4 talks about how they begin to manufacture tools, how they begin to fashion musical instruments, how buildings and structures begin to take form, and they're given great ideas of how great architecture should look. And from the beginning, humanity was blessed with this bright intellect, and they began to create culture and make God's world even more glorious as his great handiworker, as his great handyman in his world. And all of us, you and me today, this is still our calling. We all have various vocations in life, right? And whatever we do, it is to be done in excellence, and it's to be done to bring glory to God. That's how Paul instructed the Colossians in Colossians 3:20, whatever you do, in word or deed, do all for the glory of God. And that's really just fulfilling the created purposes that God gave us in the very beginning. We're just not created just to stay in the garden and worship 24/7, 365. No, we're to have the garden sanctuary where we worship God, but we're also to be at work in the world, right? We have two roles to play. We have the garden role to play, and then we have the worldly work that we're supposed to play. And all of it is to be bringing glory to God. And we need both of those places, right? We need to have a firm foot in both of those places. So when we see the creation of the world here, we saw how in Genesis 1, it's a three-tiered world. Well, in Genesis 2, we see when God creates the garden, he really shows us three different zones of God's world. And let me just read again something that Lightheart writes. He writes, Genesis 2:8 tells us that the Lord God plants a garden toward the east in Eden, which means that the garden is on the east side of the land of Eden. Eden is larger than the garden, and outside Eden there are other lands, which are named in Genesis 2:11-13. It's actually Genesis 2:11-14. And the lands are Havilah, Cush, and Assyria. These are all the lands that are created alongside of the land of Eden. There are many more lands, but these are just the lands in which, from which the four rivers flow to. And if Adam had, Lightheart goes on to say, if Adam had taken on the first day to make a map, he would have drawn a map with several areas, the garden, the land of Eden, and the larger world. So I just want to maybe take time to draw the map that Adam would have taken to draw. And so here we see the world, and then we see Eden, and then east in Eden, we see the garden, okay? So there's the garden, here's Eden, and here's the world. And then out from the garden flows the river that breaks into four different rivers. And we have it going to the land of Havilah, Assyria, and Cush. Okay? So this is the original layout of God's created world. And really what we see this layout, we see it correspond in redemptive history again and again to the way that God structures how the tabernacle is to be created, what the land of Israel looks like. So in some way, we could say that Israel later will correspond to the land of Eden, the garden will correspond to the tabernacle, the tree in the garden will correspond to the Holy of Holies, or where the Ark of the Covenant is, and the world will correspond to the world. Now, even at the beginning of creation, God had designed the world so that there was a special garden sanctuary to worship. And from where his worshiping and rested creatures, they would go out and they would beautify the world around them. They are called, what does God tell them in Genesis 1 to do? They are to go out and they are to have dominion. They are to rule. They are to subdue the earth. They were to follow the river which flowed from God's paradise on a high plateau or a high mountain and went out to water the world. And in a sense, Adam and Eve and all their descendants were to be God's water to the world. As the handiwork of God and his image bearers and kingly ambassadors, they were to bring the rule and reign and beauty and order of God to the world around them. Now, does Adam fulfill his kingly and priestly duty of guarding and working the garden? He doesn't, right? He doesn't, at least initially. He falls. And this is what Lightheart writes. I want to read it to you. He says, called to guard the garden, Adam lets in a serpent who tempts Eve while he stands by watching. So a lot of times, you know, people depict Eve as if she's alone with the serpent. No, it says that she gives the fruit right to Adam, who's right there with her. That's in Genesis 3:6. And Lightheart continues, called to serve God in the garden, he listens to the voice of Satan. Because of this, Adam and Eve are driven from the garden, and cherubim are set up to prevent their return. Genesis 3:24. All through the Old Testament, no man was ever able to return to the garden. Adam messes up the world, not just for himself, but for everyone who follows him. The rest of the Old Testament is all about what God does to prepare for the coming of the seed of the woman. So after Adam and Eve fall, God places cherubim at the gates of Eden. Look, I'm going to read Genesis 3:24 to you. Genesis 3:24. So he, God, drove out the man, and he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. So here, now in the east of the Garden of Eden, we have where the gates are, right here, the gates. And we have the flaming sword, right, with the cherubim who's guarding the gates. And they're cast out of out of the garden. They're still living in Eden. They're still living, you know, somewhere in Eden here. But they can't re-enter the garden. They can't go through the gates. It's barred from them. God sets a heavenly messenger on assignment to make sure they never go in there again, so they will not eat of the tree of life and live forever in their cursed state. Now, look what Lightheart goes on to say about all the directions that are given here, the east and the west. He says this: if you want to return to the garden, you have to travel west. And moving east is moving away from the garden. All through the Bible, east and west have this meaning. Cain is cast out of the land and wanders in Nob, which is east of Eden, Genesis 4:16. So here we have Nob, right, is over here. Nob. This is where Cain goes and builds his city, okay? The city of Cain. And then he goes on to say, Lot moves east and settles near Sodom. Again, east is the direction away from the garden of God. When Israel enters the land of Egypt, they circle around to Moab and cross Jordan from the east. This shows that entering the land flowing with milk and honey is like returning to the garden. They're going from the east to the west. They don't just come up from the south, but they go literally across the Jordan so they can go east to west, symbolizing return to God. Later, when Israel goes into exile, they are taken to the east, away from the land, and to return, they travel west. In the New Testament, the wise men come from the east to west, seeking the garden and Jesus, the real tree of life. So we see this movement even, we'll get into it next week when we come to the Tower of Babel. They are traveling east. And we see this theme again and again. And the directions almost always have their reference point in the first mention of east and west, which has to do with the garden here in Genesis 3. And here's even another example. After God redeems Israel from the serpentine character of Pharaoh, he shows Moses the heavenly tabernacle on Mount Sinai, and he tells him to copy it. And it is a picture of Edenic worship, of restoration to the presence of God. And the gates of the tabernacle were on the east side of the tabernacle. But instead of the gates being closed, the gates were always open to come and worship, because God was restoring worship through the sacrificial system that he had put in place. So everyone could walk through the camped out tribe of Judah, which was camped out on the east. They could walk through the tribe of praise. They could enter his gates with thanksgiving and praise in true form of worship. And they could bring their sacrificial animal, a picture of Jesus Christ, and they could have restored fellowship, restored communion with God. They could re-enter the garden sanctuary. Now, when Moses first sees, right, that when he first meets God on the mountain and Mount Sinai, and everyone is there at Mount Sinai, and they're looking up, and the thunder and the lightning, and everyone's terrified, right? Why? It's because the tabernacle hadn't been set up yet. And God, the gates were still closed, and the flaming sword was still flaming, and there was thunder, and there was lightning. It was a scary thing, right? God had to show them the cost of restored fellowship, and the cost would ultimately be pictured in the sacrificial system that he was about to give them on Sinai. Now, the way that God goes on and begins to restore fellowship throughout the rest of the book of Genesis in the story of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is they do three different things in their evangelism of Canaan. They build altars, which are like mounds. They're like mini mountains. they dig wells, and they worship God on mountains. Now, all of these three things, altars, wells, and mountains, are many Edens. There are many pictures of Edens. The patriarchal places of worship were meant to restore fellowship with God, restoring godly worship like Adam's son Seth and his son Enosh did when men began to call on the Lord again. That is what the patriarchs are doing in this place, and Abraham gains many converts as he's going out of from the east to the west. He's the first one in Scripture, actually, we're told, who journeys west. It's his journey back to God. He's following the plan of God. He's seeking the city whose has heavenly foundations, and he begins to build altars, and he begins to dig wells, and he gains converts on the way. In fact, so much so that he has 318 fighting men in his household. He probably has a household of like 2,000 people. So that's what we see going on. Lightheart says this in this section. He says, every time God meets with man on a mountain, it is a return to the garden. Because as we say, the Bible pictures Eden, and specifically the garden in Eden, as a high place, because that is from where the waters are flowing. And water only flows which direction? Downward. And so that's why every time you see a mountain and God meeting people on a mountain, it's this idea of an Eden encounter. Now, Cain and Abel, I'm going to talk a little bit. I'm going to do different things during these nights. Sometimes I might rehearse some things that Lightheart talked about. Other times I might bring in some things that he doesn't talk about. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Cain and Abel here, which he doesn't get into too much. And what I want to do is tonight think through the historical situation of this story. What was the world like post-garden life when they are barred from the Garden of Eden and they're still living in the land of Eden? Well, we are told that Adam and Eve have children and that they are worshiping the Lord. The Lord had clothed Adam and Eve in animal tunics, and now Adam and Eve begin to worship the Lord with slain sacrifices. God shows them how to worship, and they begin to worship rightly. And they're likely worshiping, I imagine, on each Sabbath, on each day seven, as God had set up that order in Genesis 1. And the Bible indicates that Adam and Eve and their entire family are still living in the land of Eden. Okay, so they're all still in Eden at this point, after being kicked out, and they're worshiping God. And it seems reasonable that their worship occurred near the closed gates of Eden. I would imagine that is probably the historical situation. We don't know for sure. And that God honored and accepted their worship with some heavenly sign, as we're told that he accepted Abel's worship but rejected Cain's worship. Now, Adam and Eve have likely had many children up until the time we are told about Cain's murder of Abel. The first command that God gave Adam and Eve was to be fruitful and multiply, and they are likely multiplying rapidly after being shown the grace of God after their fall, when they're given their tunics and they're given the promise of the conquering seed, which is, I'm sure, what they rehearsed and preached to each other every single week, right? Wow, look how gracious God is. He's restored us to our kingly and priestly roles, and we actually can still image him. We actually can still be like him in this world. Now, in fact, Josephus, a Jewish historian during the time of Jesus, he says that Jewish tradition maintained that Adam and Eve had 33 sons and 23 daughters. That's 56 kids. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I would think that they probably even had more kids, because remember, Adam lives to 963 years old, and the childbearing age lasts much longer than it does today. Especially since Adam, we're told, has Seth when he's 230 years old. So if Adam and Eve averaged a kid every 2 years, it would mean they had 115 kids by the time they had Seth, and they probably had more kids after Seth. So I'm just saying, so who knows really, but here's the verse about Adam's age and the birth of his children. Genesis 5:3. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness. Now, the Septuagint says he lived 230 years. There's one letter added here, which adds an extra 100 years. I talked about this last year when we went through Bible chronology, and I think the Septuagint is right. I don't have time to explain tonight why that's the case, but I think Adam was 230 years old when he begot a son in his own likeness and his own image and named him Seth. And then after he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, or in the Septuagint, 700 years, and he had sons and daughters. So what's going on with Adam, Eve, and all their children in the land of Eden for the first 230 years of their lives before Cain kills Abel? Well, Adam had been restored in his office as king and priest, and like Aaron, who had four sons who led worship with him at the tabernacle, Adam had different worship leaders. He had his two oldest boys, Cain and Abel, in their greatly matured state, probably over 200 years old at this time, who would have led worship for the family and taught the family about the promise of the seed who would crush the serpent and restore them to Eden, and would have taught them about how God created his good worlds and created them as image bearers and likeness bearers, what they were to do in the world, how they were supposed to live. And these men didn't just have a priestly function. The Bible says that they had a vocation, right? It says that Cain was a farmer and that Abel was a shepherd or a herdsman. But one of these sons, Cain, decides to have a liturgical innovation. He decides to worship God differently. And like the two sons of Aaron who offered strange fire before the Lord and were rejected and killed, actually, so Cain offers an unacceptable sacrifice before the Lord, and the Lord rejects it. He says this is a false form of worship. His progressive approach to worship was not progressive, but it was regressive. It was not centered around the slain lamb who would take away our sins, but rather the fruit of his own labor. And God does not look at the fruit of our own labor as acceptable. He needs the blood of an innocent substitute. He accepts Abel's substitutional sacrifice and worship, but he rejects Cain's works-based worship. So what happens when Cain sees this, right? And I imagine he's leading many people in worship, and he maybe hears of Abel at another time leading many people in worship, and maybe they're comparing the worship services. And what happened? Cain, his pride is hurt, right? And all the worshipers, their pride was hurt too, who were worshiping with Cain. So in order to reestablish his position, he thinks he will kill his brother while no one is looking and restore his position. But his murder was not hidden from the eyes of the ever-seeing God. Abel's blood was crying out to God from the ground, and Cain is banished from the land of Eden as a fugitive and as a vagabond. Look what it says in Genesis 4, verse 16. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city and called the name of the city after the son of his son, Enoch. Now this is not the Enoch who was translated into heaven. That was a different Enoch who was the seventh generation of the son of Seth. But sometimes when people read this verse, I see it occur all the time, and I think it's such a silly statement. But people ask, well, where did Cain's wife come from? Did he find her in the land of Nod and marry her? Well, the answer is really not that difficult. Cain's wife came from Adam and Eve. What does Genesis 3:20 say? And Adam called his wife's name Eve. Why? Because she was the mother of all living. Okay? There it is. Now, to Cain go out and find this woman in the land of Nod and marry her? No. He's probably been married to her for a couple centuries in the land of Eden, and they move to Nod and have another baby. Now, Cain, obviously, his wife is limited to two options. Either she was his sister, which is most likely, or she was his niece, right? But being the oldest son, it's likely that most likely it was his sister. And at this time, incest was not a sin, obviously. It was the only way to propagate. It only becomes sinful once the law of Moses comes in. Even when Noah has to repopulate the world, the sons and daughters of Shem, Ham, and Japheth would have been marrying their first cousins. We know Abraham married a half-sister. Isaac married a cousin. On top of that, we have an idea of when Cain was exiled as a fugitive and vagabond. So that's what's happening, and This is what we're told happens when Adam and Eve give birth to Seth as a replacement for Abel, who was killed after 230 years of their life. Genesis 4:25 says this, "And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth, for God had appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord." So Seth would become the line that would carry the seed of the Messiah in replacement for Abel. No other son of Adam and Eve would carry that seed. That is why it is in the days of Seth and his son Enosh that men begin to call on the name of Yahweh. Seth and Enosh preserve faithful worship in the earth, the sort of faithful worship that Abel was leading people in. When many of the other children of Adam and Eve began to follow in the way of Cain, Cainite worship, workspace worship, and they were really drifting east of Eden to the land of Nob and other lands, east of the garden and east of Eden. Eventually, most of the world would join the Cainite church and worldview, and the world would, the Bible says in Genesis 6 that the world becomes full of violence and sinners. God would have to start over with one faithful Sethite, a man named Noah, who's the 10th in line from Adam through Seth and his family. It's a picture of the one righteous man, Jesus Christ, through whom the whole world would start over and be made new. But what is going on at the time of Cain where he moves east of Eden? Well, remember we read that Seth was born when Adam and Eve are 230 years old. And this is this means that, you know, there's 230 years of faithful worship before the liturgical coup under Cain, who's serving the altar as priest. And so I imagine by this time, if we assume there's a conservative population growth at this time, say we have the same population growth that's occurring in Somalia in the world today, and if you assume that that was the population growth at that time, that means there would be 10,000 people at this time. If we assume a larger growth, which probably there was a larger growth because there was longer childbearing ages, there would have been well over 100,000 people at this time. And so, you know, Cain and Abel were both leading prominent, I think, churches of children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, etc. So when Cain moves east of Eden at 230 years old, he is likely moving with a sizable crowd that had been schooled in his new way of living and worshiping. And we know his wife leaves with him. We imagine many others as well. This is how he can go and build the first city in the land of Nod, which he names after his son Enoch. So likely hundreds or thousands go and build this city with him. This is where culture takes form under Jubal and Jubin and Tubal-Cain. And this scene I've been describing really is nothing new. In fact, one of the most famous church theologians, and the most famous church theologian of the early church was a man by the name of Augustine. And in his greatest work, his biggest work that he wrote at the end of his life, it's called The City of God. And he writes very similar sort of scene. He says this, "The sacred history does not necessarily mention all the men who might be alive at that time, but only those whom the scope of his work required him to name. Neither is it necessary to suppose that Enoch was Cain's firstborn, because he named his city after him." He goes on to say, "Though no one attained the age of 1,000 years, several exceeded the age of 900. Who then can doubt that during the lifetime of one man, the human race might be so multiplied that there would be a population to build and occupy not one, but several cities?" He said, Augustine writes about Adam having Seth at 230 years old. "Are we to understand that during this long term of years over which one lifetime extended in those early days, there might not have been born very many men, by whose united numbers not one but several cities might have been built?" And so that's how we sort of what's going on. You have two different religions. You have two different ways of worship. And ultimately, it is the serpentine worship that gains control over people, so much so that only one righteous man is left in the world, and that is Noah. I imagine Noah is actually going to the gates of Eden and actually offering a slain sacrifice like Abel did, right? I believe he is, in that sense, walking in the way that of worship that God had showed them how to worship. And he is a recommissioned man. He is a recommissioned Adam. He starts over after the chaotic waters fill the earth for a whole year. So God preserved the world. Well, he creates a world in miniature. He creates a three-story house. The ark is constructed three stories to preserve the world. He will preserve a remnant of everything, two of every kind of kind, a male and a female, and seven of every clean animal will be on board the ark and enter the new world. Noah will be a new Adam in the world. And he is given the same assignment with the same duties, be fruitful and multiply. And he's also given not just that, but he's given kingly duties, capital punishment. And that is also the reason why he has wine and the rest that comes with wine. He's supposed to have reached an even more mature state than Adam, just as the second Adam, Jesus Christ, is the ultimate matured state of Adam. So, later in the story of Israel, we see Moses is placed into an ark and put in the water. When we hear that Moses is put into an ark and placed in water, what are we supposed to think about? Well, we're supposed to think about Noah, right? We're supposed to think, okay, this is a new Noah, this is a new Adam, this is a new deliverer who will bring the old world to destruction, Egypt, and bring his people into a new redeemed state. So these images are repeated over and over, and we'll get to that more, I think, when we go into the story of Moses. But let's stop here. We'll get into a few questions. I want to go over just two of the review questions, and then we'll see if anyone has any other questions, want to discuss things further here. Genesis 10, we'll probably talk about that a little bit more next week. That's where God gives the table of nations. He's wanting the people to fill the earth. He wants the nations of the world to spread and worship him from every corner of the created world. And we'll get into how they disobey him next week. But here's one of the review questions. Let's just look at the first review question. What does it mean for Adam to be the image of God? Anyone want to answer that question out there? What does it mean for image? For Adam to be the image of God. Yes. Okay. Good. Any other thoughts? To be a copy, right? Copy God. Good. Okay. Yeah. Any other? Work as God works. Good. Right. Be ye therefore imitators of God as dear children, right? Ephesians 5:1. Okay, let's go to the thought question, number one. Read Ephesians 1:21-23. Noticing how Paul refers to Genesis 1:26-28. What is Paul telling us about Jesus? So let me read to you Ephesians 1:21. This is talking about Christ, where Christ has been exalted. Far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that which is to come. And he put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. So how does that verse, what is Paul telling us about the position of Jesus? Just like God had originally appointed Adam to be over everything, to have dominion over everything, right? Now, is there any difference between Adam's position and Jesus' position here? Right? Right. And I think it's good there comparing the serpent. Who is the serpent according to Revelation 12? Satan, right? And so, he's a spiritual being, right? And we would say he's likely a fallen angel, right? And so when Christ is being exalted here, he's now being exalted not just above all of earth like Adam was exalted, but he's being exalted above all of heaven. Remember on day 2 when God creates the firmament to separate the earth and the heaven and all of God's spiritual creatures are in the heavenly places. Well, Christ has now a position above even all of those spiritual creatures, right? He is above the angels and the archangels and the seraphim and the cherubim. And here he is seated at the right hand of God in majesty. And who is there with him? You and me. He made us to be seated with him in heavenly places. Ephesians 2:6. Where are we seated? Our position of authority and of dominion and favor is now even higher than that Adam had. It is in the highest heavens. It is in the highest realm of heaven. It's in a position of fully redeemed state. So, that's sort of my take on it. I don't know if that's what Lightheart was intending to pull out, but. Well, let's go. Anyone have any questions about the book or about what was taught tonight? Yeah, right. Well, I think it's definitely, some people say it was removed like before God flooded the earth, the whole of paradise. Others say that it was just destroyed during the earth. But I think, yeah, if it's the same tree of life, yeah, it would have been preserved and God would have removed it from the earth. So that the theme, I think if I remember right, the theme is that the man always meets his bride at the well. And so Jesus meets his bride, and the woman in the Gospel of John, that theme there is, whenever you meet a woman in the Gospel of John, it is a picture of the church. And it's a picture of, right, Christ redeeming his bride, you and me, to Eden, to heaven. Always in the well and the water. And that's why the patriarchs would dig the wells. That's right. Yeah, Rachel met Jacob at the well. That's right. And and Moses meets Zipporah at the well. And that's why what does the enemy do? It stops up the wells. What did Isaac have to do? Or is it Jacob? He has to redig the wells, right, that his father had originally dug. And that's what worship is. When the enemy stops up true worship, we have to redig the well. So, you know, I think, right, we got to train our children in the way they should go. And I think, you know, some things more we can do is, you know, like Paul talks about, you know, thinking on things which are pure, lovely, noble, good report. We have to meditate. We got to chew on. We have to take time to digest. And only then, I think, does that then become part of our habits. So as we digest the word, it'll become part of our habits. We can live out the word. We can do the word. So we got to know who we are so we can begin to act like who we are. So we got to meditate on the redemptive realities. Yes, so I'm right. Well, last January I taught on this kind of in depth, and so the Septuagint, it says he was 230 years old. And 130, right. So there are a few places in the Septuagint that differ from what's called the Masoretic text. And this book I have down here on the bottom, Rebooting the Bible, it gets to this question in depth. And I can give you my notes from last January because I'm telling you, it's a very long and complicated answer. Yeah, it's a very long and complicated answer. But it actually has to do with, I think, a change that happened in the 2nd century AD by the Jews, by a rabbi named Akiba, where I think he made a few changes in Genesis 5 and also to some of the messianic prophecies in books like the Psalm. And this is why the early church largely used the Septuagint. So for instance, even Augustine, who I'm quoting, he would have used this longer chronology at 230 years. Peggy? Yes.
But I've always been confused about Genesis 7:2, where it says seven.
Yeah. So he takes seven of every clean animal. And so remember, after he exits the ark, what does he do? He offers sacrifices of what? All of the clean animals. How can he offer sacrifices? Well, because there's more than two of them.
So
and so.
Is there a double meaning to that seven?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the number seven is significant always in Scripture, right? Beginning with Genesis 1, which is 7 days. It's an idea of completeness. So, yeah, that there's a complete number of clean animals, that the clean animals, in some sense, are more significant than the other clean, unclean. Right. Well, after, they don't eat animals, though, until they land. So they wouldn't have been eating animals on the ark. But after they land and God sacrifices, he gives them the animals as food to eat. That's why we can eat animals today. We don't have to all be vegetarians. But Adam and Eve, all the way up to Noah, were likely all vegetarians, except those who were probably following the Cainite religion. In fact, if you watch the movie Noah, which came out in 2013 or 14, it makes a big deal of this whole vegetarian thing. Now, a lot about that movie I don't like, because it gets into some weird Jewish Kabbalah stuff, but it makes some interesting points. Yes, it's in both, it's in the beginning of Revelation and the end. Jesus, in speaking to one of the seven churches, talks about how those who overcome will eat of the tree of life. And then in Revelation 21 and 22, when we're given the picture of the garden city in heaven, I think we see the tree of life there as well. So I don't have the exact... yeah, I would say, I mean, I see no reason not to think that, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I think it could be a symbol, too, of Jesus Christ, the tree of life. I mean, some people have drawn connections, like, to the cross with the tree of life, and, you know, Jesus shedding his blood is, you know, the fruit of that tree that brings us life, you know, but, so there might be both a literal and a symbolic nature to it, I don't know. But, yeah, It says we will eat of the tree of life, though. That's what it says in Revelation. So I think we will do that. Yeah. Okay, John. I think that they were the sons of Adam and Eve. Yes, I do. So there's like three different positions on who the Nephilim are. So I think it was the intermingling. I think the sons of God were the sons of Seth, and I think the daughters of men were the daughters of Cain. But a lot of Jews during the time of Jesus didn't believe that. They thought the sons of God were angels, and the daughters of men, and that's how there became giants in the land, and so men of renown. So I just don't see... I see when God creates in Genesis 1, everything, it reproduces after its own kind, both animals and plants. So I don't see how men as one kind and angels as another kind could reproduce a third kind. So that's why the main reason why I don't accept that reading. But some people hold to that, but I think it's kind of, I don't. But, you know, who knows what it is? I really don't know. I don't really know what the giants are. There were giants. It could be in a metaphorical sense of giants. They're men of renown. I mean, we're told great stories of this great golden age of people who do exploits and things, you know, that are great. So I don't really know, but it's a good question. I don't think anyone really knows.
And the mark of Cain?
The mark of Cain, yeah.
It was something people could see, so they wouldn't kill him.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, Martin Luther, he talks about the mark of Cain like it had something to do with Cain's demeanor, like people were repulsed by it. Some say it was like a physical mark. But yeah, it was, in some sense, it was a grace that was given him where he's protected. All right, one more question, then we'll end. One more question. No more? All right. Awesome. Well, good. So... I have, like I said, I have the books over here for anyone who needs a book, and we'll just read the next section. Let me pull it up so I see what it is here. For next week, we are reading, okay, yeah, from Between Babel and Bethel, Genesis 11 to 12, 17 and 35. So it's about 8 pages. Excuse me. And then the time after that, we'll make it to chapter 2.